Blog Talk Radio.
Listening to Patriot Nation Radio Live, 347-637-3942.
Hey, welcome back to the show. This is Kevin White. We do have a call-in number, 347-637-3942. Welcome back to the program on another Wednesday. Good to have you back. The weather is great now. I am so happy with this. I got my gardening done over the weekend, and I enjoy warm weather. It's not like that in Ohio all the time. It's been a struggle this year to get up to 70 degrees. You know, we have frost in springtime and all that, but we're back. And, you know, the mood is just different, something about it. But tonight, we have a guest tonight, Mr. Langley. Actually, I'm going to read his resume for you guys, and it's fantastic. So Mr. Conrad Langley is a retired colonel in the U.S. Army, and a retired attorney, New York State Attorney General Officer. So Mr. Conrad went from the military, got his law degree, and is actually a fantastic resume person. He's been in several wars, including the Cuban Missile Blockade, Vietnam, Cold War in Germany, Central America, Panama. I've been there. I was there just before the last war. Desert Storm, and also served United Nations as an advisor, a legal advisor. This is incredible. And he served the military from 1962 to 2005. That is a long, long time. I didn't think that was possible, but he did it. That's amazing. New York State Attorney General's Office, 1974, 2010. And what I love about this, this is fantastic. He would be hired right away. I would see this and say yes. But he got a he's got an MS in strategic studies, juris from Buffalo Law School, 1974, MBA from Harper College in New York. So, but what I really like is he has been awarded the Lefkowitz Award, New York State's highest legal award, by then Attorney General Mario Cuomo.
Well, actually, the son.
Oh, okay. The son. Got it. Yes. So I don't remember. I'm not from New York. What was his son's last name again?
Kicked out of office.
Oh, yeah. Yes.
I worked for him for several years.
It's all right, though, you know. I can't remember myself. I used to know, but it's been so long ago, you know. You forget about these kind of things. It's trivial stuff you don't remember. You know how that goes. So tell us about your military career, because that's one reason I wanted you on, because you used to do some dangerous things, I understand, you know, with bombs and weapons and things like that. Could you tell us about your career, how you started and what you did?
I finished boot camp just in time to be involved in the missile blockade. From then, I went to submarine base, Pearl Harbor, Hawaii.
Wow.
And then when the Vietnam War started, myself and a friend volunteered. They were sending destroyers out there. So we both got destroyer assignments. He left about a month before I did, and he was dead in a week.
Cool.
Shot, through the first 7 weeks there, he somehow managed to get himself shot, of course, by the VC in an ambush. But when I went out there, they made me, I was a torpedoman, but there was no real need for torpedoman, but we were assigned for gunfire support duty between the rivers and the sea, because that was before they had the specialized craft, so they were using destroyers for that. So we'd go up river and to support U.S. Marines and South Vietnamese troops. And I was a gun captain, one of our two gun bombs. So we fired thousands of shells at various enemies, and our most exciting thing was the all-night battle on what they call the Tati River Bridge. The Tati River Bridge was a critical bridge across Highway 1, Route 1 through South Vietnam, and it was the road that connected the Marines at Da Nang with the DMZ. And the VC decided to cut that road to keep the U.S. Marines was just arriving in force to keep them from slow down their deployment in the rest of Vietnam. And so they threw a intelligence error. The U.S. Marines sent the troops, blocking troops, to the wrong place.
Oh, boy.
At the last minute, my ship got ordered to head up the Tati River. Because we were the only thing between a handful of Marines, the South Vietnamese troops, and a battalion of BC reinforced by Red Chinese troops for the first time entering the war. That was the one and only time they entered the war. So we spent the night just blasting these troops as they broke out of the, with firing, we launched flares and into the sky in the air. We blew up the star shell, and the enemy kept breaking all night long. They would break out of the jungle and race to the bridge, and we hit them with everything we had, like bright phosphorus, BT frags, like giant shotgun shells, and we spent the night, and by morning, they still held. That was one of the more interesting things I did then. And after that, I got out of the military. I stayed in the reserves, though. And for a while, I was in Special Forces Reserves. That was another story, but I didn't stay that long there because I had planned to go back to Vietnam and the Special Forces, but then they decided to pull the Special Forces out of Vietnam. And I just left Special Forces and went back into the Navy after that. There's no point at night. Meanwhile, I went to undergraduate, law school, and upon completing law school, I joined the Army JAG Corps and took a leave of absence from the Attorney General's office, one of the first of several. I was a double dipper. I stayed in the boat retirement system. That was my first time. I went to Germany for 3 years. I was with the 8th Infantry Division. And then when I came back, I got in a reserve unit that primarily supported U.S. troops in Central America, Honduras, Panama, and I spent about 10 short tours for several years in either Honduras or Panama. Those were the days when they were supplied, when we were assisting the Contras from Honduras.
Really? Wow. Yeah. That's incredible.
Well, then, and one of my last tours was when they were down, well, that wasn't one of my last tours. There, one of my tours there was down there, and I was delayed getting out of there because they were sending all, I was down in Panama then, they were sending all these troops into Panama. And we were doing odd things. We were doing our PT runs early in the morning, and we were making a big show of it, running around the Panamanian National Guard there.
Really?
This was Cywar. And a few days later, we went for them, and they stayed in their barracks because they were afraid. If guys got up that early in the morning when they were still sleeping, were running around, ready to go. They had no intention of fighting us when they decided to knock off Noriega.
Yes, that's interesting because, what base were you at? Were you at Fort Huachuca?
Fort Clayton.
Okay, yeah. I was at Howard Air Force Base.
fluid and not a hollow.
Uh-huh. Yes, right. So the Contras, right?
Yeah, that was up in, they operated, we, I was at, up in Honduras at the military base, you know, and we had the air base there. But that was where the U.S. aid for the Contras came in.
Wow.
And my primary job there was go out in the stick and pay for, pay the local mayors for exercise damages that were caused by the U.S. shifting people in and out, and equipment and supplies in and out, so that Hondurans would be happy enough as they take over anything that went toward Nicaragua.
That's history right there, because I remember I heard about the Contras and everything. It never was real to me until just now. So, I mean, Reagan was president at the time, I believe. Awesome. Wow, that's something else. And after that, you can elaborate a little more about your career.
After that, I had an opportunity. Iraq invaded Kuwait, and they were starting to send people there. So, and there was a unit out of New York City, and they needed a staff drug advocate. And he was supposed to be a lieutenant colonel position, but I was a major. But I asked, but the guy who was supposed to do it didn't want to do it. Who had the job?
Right.
Looking around, trying to find a lieutenant colonel who was willing to do it, because at that point nobody knew what was going to happen. They thought they were predicting 40,000 dead, and this sort of thing, and people were afraid. I was afraid, but it didn't bother me any. So they went through a dozen lieutenant colonels and colonels who wouldn't take the job.
Really?
I said, well, can a major take a one up? They said, wow, you're gone. Eventually, I got orders within an hour, and I was on my way, so I was... I was in the support unit for the American force for the reserve army support. We provided we were the group that took care of the ships and the planes and supplies, and we were responsible for the rear areas to get set up fuel depots, everything brought to the war for the theater. That was our job. And they gave us, as an additional duty, they planned we were going to be the support unit for Kuwait, for the liberation of Kuwait. They anticipated that it would take some time, so we were going to set up a log base inside Kuwait and while the war went on. But when we got there, on our way there, they didn't expect the Iraqis to collapse that quickly. So essentially, we... in there almost unopposed, we came through there. The only thing that happened was I was in the convoy with the aiming for the city that they wouldn't send regular units in, but they let us support units to join the actual city. The occupation for the city was supposed to be Kuwaitis and Air Forces. So they put us in the convoy where we were going to provide we were the guys who would turn the lights on, got fuel running, get food in there, and coordinate that. So we had to be in there at the start as the Iraqis were pulling out. So they sent us in with the Aero convoy.
Interesting.
One of the most interesting things on the way is they drove through a minefield, and these vehicles started blowing up around me, and my vehicle jumped up in the air, sailed up in the air, hit an anti-personnel probably, but it came down again, and I looked around. And I still had two legs, two arms.
Right.
The guy next to me with a vacuum tank.
Really?
He apparently couldn't take it. He just couldn't stop.
Yeah, but the most of...
So we basically raised to put out the oil fires. It's an interesting thing. We were located in, not at the regular base, we were down in, they had a special, in a former Kuwaiti school inside the city of Kuwait, where our unit was, because they wanted to close the port, things like that. And And one of the things was interesting, we hear gunshots at night, and sometimes we find a dead Palestinian alley behind us because the Kuwaitis were trying to force Palestinians to leave. They were successful in doing so, but there was a little bit of intimidation.
Wow.
Then they were going to give us, they thought we did such a swell job to assist the Kurds in northern Iraq.
I'm very familiar with them, yes.
We started a campaign to get back in the New York City doing to get back in New York City, excuses to get back for the parade. And they put, actually there was an article in the Daily News about for my efforts to try to get us out. Because my commander encouraged me to do a letter writing campaign. But they did let us go just before the parade. We got going. They canceled. They forced the army to buy a new unit to send to Iraq and to relieve the reservists. Because they apparently, one problem was the regular army couldn't wait to leave, and they took off, and they left us behind. And the idea was they were just going to keep us there indefinitely almost.
Wow.
One problem is there when they announced this, well, there was one of the staff officers, not me, but he wrote a letter to Congress complaining about it. And our commanding general was the support staff and doused him for doing that. So then he wrote another letter pointing out that you have a constitutional right to contact the Congress. And Congress decided, ordered him to relieve the National Guards and the Reserves after that.
Gotcha.
Oh, well, anyhow, that was, then we were back, and we went back to keep for a while, a couple of years, until Clinton decided to intervene in Bosnia.
Right.
Part of my unit went to Bosnia, but because I had some interesting experience, I had a wide-ranging experience with international law, they needed somebody to, there was a full-time Marine who was acting, who accompanied the United Nations mission to, they had the, when they, in the Bosnia deal, the way it worked out, Croatia said they wouldn't go along with it unless they got back the last Serb held areas in Croatia. So they had the Dayton Accord, the agreement that regulated Bosnia. But at the same time, they had the Erdu Accord, which set up an arrangement where the Croatian would get back its last enclave after a two-year UN turnover period. And so they created the United Nations UNCTAD, and it stood for United Nations Administration of East Slavonia, Serbia, and the other place, they were archaic names and stuff, basically, you know, for the region, what they were called. This Marine that went on the mission, the Marine said that's not a Marine mission, and told the active-duty Marine to get out of there, and he needed a replacement. And the U.S. Reserve Lieutenant General, Air Force guy, was actually, he had a master's title. He was actually U.N. administrator, and he wanted, he needed a replacement for the Marine, because he had a handful of Americans that actually ran the mission, because they didn't trust the U.N., he didn't trust the U.N. people, considered them all lazy and inefficient. They didn't get the job, they didn't take orders well. So we had a half a dozen, and they had a U.N., the regular U.N. guy, who was the U.N. Legal advisor for the mission, but he wanted an American to backstop him or to actually help him along or whatever. So they gave him my name, and he interviewed me and decided that I was acceptable. So I went off to, they gave me orders. I went, they sent me to the European Command in Stuttgart, And then that separated me from the Army. I always said that the same thing the Marines have said, that you can't send an Army soldier on an unauthorized U.N. mission. There was no provision or anything. But
right.
It was informal, but the Europeans, the Air Force General, Lieutenant General, who was the deputy commander at UCOM, was good friends of the UR ambassador of the Air Force, Major General, who was the UN administrator, and they were all, so for political reasons, he decided he was going to, this guy got it, they were willing to bend the rule, as long as I was willing to go. So they sent me, they basically told me, they sent me a copy of a proposed order, set of orders that I had somebody type up and I had somebody sign them. And they were orders to a fake U.S. command in Zagreb, Croatia.
Really?
You're there.
Yeah.
So I showed up in Zagreb, and I met, and the Marine who was about to leave showed up with a guy who was the chief of the civilian police in our area. And that guy, he was an Irish cop. It's a senior position in the Dublin Police Force. But those two showed up, and they got in, we got in the car, and we just drove for about 300 miles. So in a straight line, out of there, and came into a Russian checkpoint. But the mission, the primary troops in the mission were the Russians, because they were friends with the Serbs, and they were considered, so they used Russian troops, and that was some of the things is, when I got there, I was involved with negotiating the reopening the borders, and I had a series of treaties I managed to get between, the borders were with Hungary and Croatia, and I represented the UN and informally represented the Serbs to try to negotiate this over the period I was there, so we could gradually open the borders and minimize incidents.
Interesting. So, yeah, go ahead.
Things like that. At Christmas time, we all went to mass at the Catholic Church, and the people rolled grenades down the aisles.
No way.
And we had a rule, if you wrecked your car, they wouldn't replace your car unless it got machine guns, which did happen occasionally. The UN vehicles would get machine guns. One morning I was driving out the gate, and they came over, run up to me, and then our former Ethiopian secretary, they come running up, I said, stop, they're shooting at him. Whoops. It was a sniper who was taking out people coming out the gate. What a
whoa.
In the end, they ruled the sniper was mentally incompetent, and because it would have been a violation of the rules if they officially admitted that it was a Serb militia run, but they decided he was a loner acting on his own. Well, that was an interesting mission. From then on, things kind of slowed down after that. I ended up going to the War College, being promoted to first colonel, was given a job with a staff judge advocate of a training division that got deployed to train the Iraqi army, except they held me back because I was getting short. I was reading, I was hitting the two maximums. I was hitting 30 years as an officer. As a colonel, you could only serve 30. And I was also hitting the max age of 60.
Right,
so
right.
I stayed behind, and they extended my stay as a staff judge advocate, so the person that replaced me could go to Iraq. So I missed out on that. Despite my best efforts to volunteer, I was too close to the end. So.
Right. Yeah, I understand that. I know all about the age thing. So what does so you're explaining to me what JAGs do in wartime. I've always wondered what they do in wartime. So that's very interesting to know.
Most of them don't do quite what I did. Some of the stuff I did wasn't really in the manual. You don't. I was. When I was with the UN, I had a UN civilian ID card. I was working in a civilian position. And
wow, gotcha.
And what I did, JAGs don't negotiate agreements for the United Nations with other countries.
No, no, I can't imagine that.
Stuff like that.
That's pretty deep. I mean, that's monumental in my mind. All I did was fix airplanes. You did all kinds of stuff.
But my whole career was in foreign countries, most of it. I spent 10 Christmases away from home. And even my reserve stuff, I didn't do reserve duty in the U.S. I did reserve duty somewhere else.
Right. Yeah, yeah. That's very interesting. You went from where you started to that, and your education took you a lot further, I have to say that, or your skills opened a lot of doors, I'm sure. And I did look that up, that was Andrew Cuomo, wasn't it?
Yes, Andrew, right.
Okay.
Yeah, so since he left, I forgot him.
I forgot it, too.
I got a picture of him giving me the award, though.
Really? That's awesome. I love New York. I'll just say that. I don't know what it's like today, but I used to love visiting there and, you know, seeing everything. That's pretty cool. So after your military career, what did you do? You started working for the training.
Well, I was working. I went to work in 1974, and I just took leave that I was on to – I did 4 leaves of absence.
Okay.
So I acted military. And one of the leaves, one of the last ones was when I went to the Army War College. But by the time I got there, although that's normally the next step to become a general, I passed the age limit because of a general, because I was enlisted too long and it's...
Gotcha.
I was enlisted. But that enabled me to stay 43 because I did 13 years enlisted, and then I could do another 30. By the time I got to be a full colonel, I was just missed when I could have applied to be a general. And I don't know if I would have gotten to become one or not, but who knows? It's just
yeah, I've never heard of anybody serving as long as you have.
Yeah, I didn't expect it. I was always a short timer in my mind.
Yeah.
I just stayed on a little longer, and things just happened. They let me stay on a little longer, and I just stayed on a little longer.
Yeah, fantastic. Yeah, that's pretty interesting. So that's how the other side works. So on the Air Force side, all the pilot commanders, they all go to the War College thing. So, and then they have a chance to become a general as well, and. Now, I see how that works now. I see how that fits together. But, okay, tell us about your time as working in the Attorney General's office in New York City. That's interesting these days. So,
most of what I did in the Attorney General's office was real estate. I became sort of like the real estate expert that I used to do right in my last few years. The Attorney General would issue official title opinions that local governments would want to know, do they own this or own that? And so I would author the opinion. And one of my most notorious ones about was what they call the canal on the blue line of the canal. When they created the Erie in or canal, they mapped a huge area, and they put it on the map between the blue lines, but they only built the canal in a small area in the middle.
Mm-hmm.
And many years went by, and people built towns and cities and homes and subdivisions within the blue line. And then one day, somebody made an issue out of it, and I issued an opinion that we owned that land. And
wow.
We still own that land.
Yeah.
But you can't get... a prescriptive easement against the state of New York to sell for public purposes. So the state did give them a break. All the landowners and businesses within the blue line were allowed to pay for the fair land value, not the value of the improvement, to buy for a few thousand dollars, they could buy a title to their property. A lot of them were very outraged over this, but that was, hey, would you show my opinion? And you got to, if you don't give us $5,000-$6,000, we own your house.
Wow.
But that sort of thing. And then they would give me, and I would get stuck with stuff because normally that in my job was you didn't go to court, but because I had been a defense counsel in Germany and also a trial counsel as a prosecutor, I had a lot of legal experience. They assumed I was an expert legal advisor, so my job title didn't require me to go to court, but they ended up sending me to court. And I would do appellate court decisions. I did even up in the federal courts in somewhat. I did appellate work, even though that was my regular job. And then when they had in January, February 1998, they had this horrific ice storm in northern New York, and it created this, and people were out of power in all the northern region. They lost power for a couple of weeks. And it was they decided that even though it had nothing to do with my job, the attorney general needed to send a representative, and they decided Conrad, he does all kinds of inspections and stuff. So he worked for the federal government, so they made me the attorney general's representative. So I worked with the National Guard and others to try to fly in generators from all over the country. And I spent a week with a call to bunker that I'd go home to go to sleep for a few hours and come back. At the state campus in Albany, they had a real bunker for design for if people were going to drop nuclear bombs on you. So in that bunker underground is when they operated FEMA, their emergency program that coordinated with FEMA. So I got to spend a week there. They gave me a T-shirt and a certificate for that, but I didn't really get much else out of it.
You got a T-shirt.
But it was interesting.
I bet it was. What's it like working with FEMA?
Oh, they're just like they're federal employees.
Yeah.
They're focused on their job, and that's what they're interested in, and they're not really that, and their job, they follow the rules, regulations, and the state has to check certain boxes, and we have to make sure that we check all the boxes for stuff, and then they'll come in, and they'll offer us assistance and help us get certain aid, and they'll finance our operations to some extent, to whatever to the extent they're legally allowed to, this sort of thing. I didn't work with any really higher ups or anything. They were just the regular people in the field. And they helped us coordinate with the airlift for from other National Guard units out of state, things like that, to bring in the generators.
Great, great. I like how that comes together. Air National Guard, Army probably, I'm guessing, helicopters. Cool. I've never dealt with FEMA. I've dealt with all kinds of other agencies, and I've retired Fed, but I know how the federal, I know how that works. So that's pretty cool. But people are dedicated. They have those kind of jobs where you have to actually do something. You know what I mean? Just like the Army, you have to do something. You can't just sit down.
The only thing about it that is, I would have just stayed forever in my, I was no rush to retire for the Army, but they kind of shoved me out the door, and the main thing in the state, they offered, Andrew Cuomo offered an offer that you couldn't refuse.
Mm-hmm.
He offered to give me and a certain number of people, if we agreed to retire, then we'd get extra retirement years. And if we didn't, he was going to reduce our medical benefits. But he did. He said, we're going to freeze your contribution for your share of the medical benefit, for your retirement medical benefit. We'll freeze it for some time at this level. But if you don't retire, we're not going to, you're going to have we're going to lift this cap. We're not going to freeze it. You're going to pay whatever the going rate is when you do retire. And it's going to go up after that. But we offered to, so it was basically, I took the deal, and after I retired, my income sort of doubled because I was getting, I had pretty well maxed, I got the maximum possible out of state, and the something like, I forgot, it was like 87%.
That's fantastic.
Yeah.
That's incredible.
And I got probably about 45% of a full colonel's pay from the Army.
Awesome. Wow.
So that, well, I didn't, in a way, I would have stayed longer, and I really didn't, despite whatever I did, I never expected to, actually, it would actually pay off in the end.
Right.
And so I always figure when people thank me for my service, I think, well, I get a check every month. That's thanks enough.
Exactly. Yes. Yes, sir. I'm in the same boat. So thank you for your service. So.
Thank you.
Let's talk about your one last thing. We talked about your ethnic background, your family, your history.
Yeah. My father was a Norwegian immigrant, came here as an adult. He married my mother, who was French-Canadian, and she thought she was Irish, but she was actually Australian.
Ooh, wow.
Father's been in the British Merchant Marine, and he married her grandmother and disappeared. And for some reason, they thought he was Irish, but then when my wife, who was a member of the DAR, and she's big in genealogy, she signed up for Ancestry. I just threw in his name, and it popped up that he was born in Robe, South Australia, and he died in Horsham, Australia. And so that was in, he was a descendant. His grandmother was a currency child, what they called it. You know, it would have been his great-grandmother was with his grandmother. You know, his grandmother, what they call a currency child, I mean, she was a child of convicts.
Oh, really?
Or they call them currency children because they didn't know for a while what their legal status would be when the convicts who came to the first shipment of convicts sailed in 1797 to Botany Bay, and when there was nothing in Australia. My great-great-great-grandmother was 13 years old when she was in the first fleet. It took them 9 months to get there. When she got there, she was an insubordinate. She was flogged. There's public records of that. They sent her to the death camp in Norfolk Island, where she had my great-great-grandmother with somebody who we're not sure who or whatever, who it was, but so that was the way things were there, were then. But she apparently, when they discovered that Norfolk Island was, the incorrigibles were sent there to die, there was a scandal broke out, and the British closed Norfolk Island and gave the residents compensation. And my great-great-grandmother was given compensation, given land in Tasmania.
Really? So, how does that work? I mean, why would they drive, go like 9 months to get there? Isn't there somewhere closer, you would think? You know, I guess that was what they did back then. And
they were sending them to the colonies, but then they couldn't shut them. They had to find a new place to send the convicts.
Gotcha.
Actually, it didn't really make a lot of sense. They didn't really. You can get all. You couldn't supposedly send all the convicts there, and it was expensive. But they did it anyways. They managed to populate early Australia that way. And my but it was interesting. But it was kind of my great-great-grandmother, my great-great-grandmother married into a family who were one of the first free settlers into Tasmania. She married that family. And my great-grandfather married a woman who was born in Scotland. She was a Mackenzie, a Highlander. But her family was interesting, too, because my second great-grandmother was ostensibly the Scottish nobility or something. She lived in, she grew up in a castle. And she came to Scotland with her husband and 6 kids. He died. And so then she took the kids, she heard, and trekked overland across what was deemed to be her hostile territory at the time because they were having problems with the Aborigines. And she took her family and she to South Australia. And she married a drover who was also a Scottish immigrant. And they built the largest sheep and cattle station in South Australia. They had hundreds of thousands of acres, and they all went bankrupt in the at the end of the 19th century. But at the time, they did that. And my grandmother was my maternal grandmother, which her parents were French Canadian immigrants. One was an Acadian, and the other was of Quebec. My third great grandfather was born in Evangeline Village of Grand Pré in Acadia. And that's another story. But his family were put on a ship, and they were supposed to go to basically indentured servants, sort of part-time slave laborers in a plantation in South Carolina. His father and others seized the ship and sailed back to Canada. So they ended up, although he was Acadian, he never saw Louisiana.
You would think so, yeah.
And they also had, but because the Acadians, I had three of my great distant ancestors were Mi'kmaq Indians. And I have a lot of records of that, and I also had a couple of percent of DNA.
Whoa.
So that was big. Well, the Acadians intermarried. Most French Canadians didn't actually intermarry, but the Acadians did.
Wow. So what do you know about the Mi'kmaq?
The only thing is they were basically they weren't an Iroquoian people. They lived in what they call it Nova Scotia, but was Acadia then. In that area, the north of that area, they were the Indian predominant tribe in that area and parts of Maine. And the Abenaki were a similar group that they were related to. The Abenaki was primarily with Massachusetts, which was around Maine too. But the Mi'kmaq were, I really don't know much other than they were the tribe in the area, and many of them married the French settlers in Acadia. They intermarried, they were all relatives, they lived together.
I've never heard of them before. That's interesting. I'm looking at them right now. This is pretty interesting. Yeah, they're dressed for Canada. So I see that.
Well, yeah, they weren't really the more aggressive. The Abenaki were the ones who raided the New England colonies. Another story is my sixth great grandmother was born in Deerfield, Massachusetts. Sarah Allen, she was, Sarah Allen, when in the early 1707, I believe, was the Deerfield Massacre. She was taken as an Iroquois. These were Abenaki and Iroquoian, Canadian Iroquois. She was taken as a prisoner to Montreal. She was sold to a Frenchman who made her a household servant. Then she married a Frenchman, and she turned down an opportunity to go back to Massachusetts because by then she was perfectly happy. In fact, most female captives taken from New England refused repatriation because women had equal rights in French Canada, and they were hanging witches in Massachusetts.
Wow. Let's see.
That's another thing you discover when you do a lot of genealogy.
Yes. So I have a picture of a Mi'kmaq couple. Very interesting.
Yeah, and one of these, my true ancestry thing, had me a DNA match with an ancient Mi'kmaq.
Wow. That's incredible. I like that. That's pretty cool. So I know a lot of African Americans think they have black ancestry, and it turns out most of them do not. So I don't know where the myth comes from, but most black people don't have Indian blood. Actually, the Indians, yes.
I was going to say most French Canadians, all by legend, they're all convinced that they have heavy. Only very few actually do.
Right, right. Yeah, you get the DNA test back. My sister did, and we had nothing. But yeah, I never heard of Big Mac. That's very interesting. So I know that Native Americans in the United States, some of them owned slaves. I think in Oklahoma, black slaves.
Right.
So, and there's a chance that you could have some DNA, but, you know, there's a lot of myth going around. But, yeah, so so you got the highest award from Andrew Cuomo. At the time, was he attorney general?
Yes.
Okay. Yes. Then you're probably surprised. Huh?
That's just where he became governor.
Yes, right.
Yeah, I also have some 25 separate awards for the military, decorations and without unduplicated. So they used to call me the field marshal when I go to in our units, because I had just all these ribbons, just rows and rows of ribbons.
Wow, I like
and
that.
Some on both sides, but most of them for inconsequential. I was there, stuff. When you go to all these, there are several wars, you get the coordinated questions for each one, and I got a couple from even the UN.
You know, yeah, you know, I did notice when I first got in the military and the guard, the Vietnam guys, they were loaded. They had the biggest racks, and it makes sense because they had so many missions they went through or whatever, but it was just, it's night and day. I cannot imagine getting that many ribbons these days. So I have much respect for them. Also, so what was your take on Andrew Cuomo becoming the governor? What was your thoughts since you worked for him?
Well, he was very political. He was also took care of himself, family, his friends. But he was more or less, he's far more effective than Hochul. He could get things done, and Hochul is no more honest than he was, but you can't get anything done. He was able to manipulate people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Very shrewd, and he knew his limitations, what he could get away with. It wasn't like he was there, but, and he did, he sort of went, at least, he may not have been real, but he pretended equity. I was a civil service lawyer, and I got that award because he thought it was time for a civil service lawyer to get that award. Until I came along, they only gave it to political appointees.
Wow, that's nice.
And so they found some excuse for the giant purchase I made for the state somewhere, which kind of involved, I guess.
Yeah, but you got it. That's all that matters, right?
Yeah, that matters. So I got it all in. So but in ways it was, because his way of showing that he had the common touch and he was going to take care of everybody, whatever.
So what were your thoughts when you heard he was running? When he actually became governor, was that like, how did that hit you? Because that doesn't usually happen to normal people, to regular people. So I think that's interesting that there's a guy I used to work with or work for, next thing you know, he's the governor. Did you expect that out of him?
Well, he's very politically ambitious, and he's a Democrat, and in New York, being a Democrat is basically a prerequisite to getting elected statewide office anymore. Even though Lee Zeldin and I served in the 7th LSO together, and we were friends, we still are, and Lee came close, but, you know, it wasn't enough, because Lee is running as a Republican and not a Democrat. But the only thing about him is I didn't like, he would have been okay, except he decided he wanted to be president. He's too ambitious. And then he sacrificed what goodwill he had in order to take some politically, I thought, rather politically extreme positions to try to run to the left to become president.
Yeah.
Like his gun law that was very, it doesn't do with crime, it didn't do a thing to help crime, but it did make it hard, hard to get a gun, and he did, and it wasn't well written because they had to, one of the things, when he first passed it, they made this, the state police, the local police guns illegal, and then they had to quietly change the law so the police could have, they could carry 10 bullets or better in their guns. Things like that. And then he passed, then he went out of his way. He basically made New York the most liberal state in the country, which is, he basically, that I was surprised he got upstate, fairly Catholic state senators to go along with him.
Yeah, that is surprising.
He was a Christian of arms, and he got, but he got in that, which was that and his gun law on the abortion, he caused, you know, that was one reason why the Republicans lost there. He cut some secret deal. He cut a deal with the Republican Senate to get enough Republican votes to get them passed. Unfortunately, the Republicans voted for them, all opposed, they all lost their seats that went along with them.
Wow.
So it didn't help the Republicans in the long run.
Oh, that's not good.
He had some kind of a deal that, in fact, as the Republicans initially looked like lost their majority, he needed their majority to balance the Democrats that controlled the Assembly.
Right.
So he made a deal with a couple of the more conservative Democrats in the city, Hispanic, Puerto Ricans, to vote with the Republicans to keep their Democrats and take control of the Senate, where they would be able to, you know, maybe override him.
Wow.
Which is one reason why Hochul today is basically, if she wanted to, there's nothing she can do because the Democrats now have now veto-proof majorities in the Senate and the Assembly, so there's nothing she could do even if she wanted to do it. They basically, New York City runs the state now.
Wow. Yeah, and I can see that because just like the trial that was in New York recently, or just last week, it seems like it's so biased one way that there's no way.
Well,
you can.
The judge appears to have picked the jury.
Really?
I don't know how he got any. The jury. No one knows who the jurors were, including the defense lawyers. So how could you?
Wow.
How do you challenge a juror if you don't know who they are? You don't know anything about them. They might have been members. For all we know, that the jurors were members of the Democrat National Committee, or Hillary Clinton might have been on it.
Right.
For all we know.
Right.
That's the problem is you can't. New York City has gone so far, you're not going to be able to get. There's no even handed anything in the city.
Whoa, that's unreal. I never thought of that. I did listen to a little bit, watched a little bit of it, and I thought it was very interesting. So have you been to, one more off-topic question. Have you been to that place that they went to, they supposedly met? I understand it's crowded a lot. I can't remember what store it was.
I've never been there. I try to stay away from the city anymore because I'm a little concerned, even though if I do go there, it's in the daylight and I'm not at night. I was there in the 70s. You couldn't go out. You didn't go on the subway at night. In certain areas, anyways, you didn't.
You remember that? Was it a couple of weeks ago? The ex-Marine. Or there's no ex-Marine. Marines are always Marines. Defended, you know, the people on the subway, you know, with the chokehold. So those are people that are trained, you know, like military guys to defend themselves or to protect other people. It's not controversial, it's just that things like that make people afraid to visit New York these days.
The people I know that live there say it's not really that, but the impression they give you is that bad.
Yes, right, and that's what they say. A lot of places, you know, there's people shooting. I don't really care about that, but I like New York. I love it. I like the culture. It reminds me of Europe, kind of. They have pure food there. You know, they have the clean. They got, like, the boroughs are just like Europe, in my opinion.
Right.
Yeah, I wouldn't mind visiting. I might be going there to Manhattan for a book festival later this year. So, who knows?
The Navy Reserve Unit, the Army Reserve Unit, you sent me to Panama and Central America. They were out of Queens.
Right.
And then my actual particular unit was actually in the subunit was in the Bronx. And so that was, I knew all these, I used to go a couple times a year down there and spend a couple of days. So it was kind of nice. That was when before they cleaned the city up. But you could get, but it was still, it was a great place to visit.
I agree.
The shopping.
Yeah. Yeah, New York, there's so many things there you can get you can't get anywhere else. And I loved the food, the people. I mean, I was in Queens. I did 4 days in Queens, and a friend of mine told me you can't eat for a whole year, you can't eat at the same place through that year. There's so many opportunities and so much food, and so many people wanted to make you happy to enjoy what they had to share. And that's why it kind of reminds me of Europe. We spent 6 days in Paris. It was the same thing. I was like, this is just like New York City. Well.
Yeah. London's another place that's great. You know?
Yes. I agree. Yep. I was deployed there once. It was fantastic. So.
First went to New York when I was in law school. I was in the Navy Reserve then, and they had a girlfriend who worked for the UN, and I was another girlfriend who lived in the village. And I decided to ask for during the law school break, send me down there for a couple of weeks. So I went down there, and they made me a brig chaser. They would fly me around the country picking up deserters and bring them back.
Oh, wow.
At Brooklyn Navy Yard.
Whoa.
But during the day and the weekend, I got to see everything in it. So one girlfriend of mine at the time that lived in the village, she took me all over the UN and all these places there. It was really, it was great. And that's the other thing is, at night, you subway, you get a little nervous because you see people breaking in. They had all the staff, the candy bar machines, and people just break them all open at night, just take stuff out. They didn't bother.
Right, yeah.
They weren't really bothered. Personally, but it just kind of scared you robbing them, you wonder. But other than that, but it was kind of nice then. That was in the 70s, early 70s. Went down there, and it was really nice actually they had a movie I was the first time to tell you also then, but there was a movie where it says that, he was doing that same job with the guy, he was picking up taking them back for trial, taking them back, guys that got in trouble, these Vietnam era deserters, but whatever it is, that job was, mine wasn't too hooked up though, because I would tell the guys that I pick up that you're going to take you down there, they're going to process you out of the Navy. And they were pretty happy to do that. So they never gave me a hard time. Actually, I didn't know what they were going to happen to them, but I figured, I knew they were going to just process them out. I don't know if they were going to prison or not.
I never thought of that before. I didn't know they went after deserters like that. That's pretty deep.
Around the Northeast, and I took them up to the local jail, and I guess escorted them out of the plane, and I'd be with them, and I had a helper, so the two of us would be there.
There are things you don't know that are going on, so that's all I got to say.
Took them over the shore patrol.
Yeah, right.
But actually, you took them over the Marines. You were the shore patrol.
The Marines don't quit. They never stop being Marines.
Yeah, that was it.
Yeah. Well, sir, if you like, I can let you go. I appreciate you being on here on the program tonight, And I learned a lot of things. That's the number one thing I like to do is learn from other people and about other people. So it's up to you. I can let you go, sir, if you want to.
Oh, I did have one other thing.
Sure, yes.
That when I got, they sent me to, when I went to the destroyer in Vietnam, they flew me to Clark Air Force Base in Hawaii. Then they sent me there to Subic Bay.
Mm-hmm.
Forgot about me for a while. I was still there because they put me on an ammo ship to get to go find those head towards Vietnam. And I was there. I was in charge of the 250-pound bomb hole. And we'd go to the aircraft carriers in the dark, and everything would be lit up with red. And we'd be loading the bombs and the napalm into the cargo net, and they'd send them right on the carriers, and the planes would be sitting on the catapults, and they would take the ammo and they would directly out of our nets and slap them on the planes.
Wow.
And then the planes would shoot off as the dawn breaking, in the dark. It'd be all lit up red and everything as the planes would blast off the catapult, so they'd be over Hanoi by dawn. And this was it was fascinating. And then but when I got on the ship had, a few months earlier, had been in the Gulf of Tonkin. They were the last ship there before the Maddox arrived. In fact, I found out later from a story in Newsweek magazine that originally the North Vietnamese thought they were going after Craig, DD-885, which is my ship. They didn't realize the Maddox had replaced them. But they were on what was called the DeSoto patrols, and the guy told me about them then. And this was apparently highly classified at that time, though. The DeSoto, the ship had been in the yards of San Francisco, and they had installed special radars on there. And they had, when they went on DeSoto patrol, they had these specialists that went on board that operated these radars. These radars tracked and jammed the North Vietnamese electronic defenses. And behind every DeSoto patrol destroyer, there was South Vietnamese commandos who would raid the coast, while the North Vietnamese were distracted by the destroyer, the South Vietnamese commandos would go and attack North Vietnam, and they probably. But this was when they and there was also no second attack, anyways. But they were trying to drive. It was questionable whether the legality of the when Johnson presented his case for the us getting involved fully in Vietnam, he didn't tell people that we had provoked the attack.
Right.
He left that out of the story. And that came out. It was years later before that officially came out, but I found out about the guys who'd been there a few months earlier, and they said, that's where we got this, all this fancy equipment, and that's what we were doing.
So that's interesting because I used to live in the Philippines. I was a dependent there for 3 years, and we used to go to Subic Bay. And I didn't know the story behind all that stuff. But I did see the Navy fleet there, the Seventh Fleet, and they had beards. It's just different back then. But that is interesting. That's like some place I'd like to go back to again, but. That's an interesting mission. I can't even imagine that because, the Navy guys and the Marines are gung-ho, I mean, that's their job. They're out in the middle of it. So are the Army. The Air Force guys are not, as you know. We sit back in the next country and see how things go.
When we went to Saudi Arabia, we saw these guys running around. We landed in Riyadh, and there were these people running around in tennis shorts.
Yes.
Those are the Air Force guys. They have living in basically their apartments. And we're going to move. We move to a tent.
Right. Yes. That's how it works. Hotel. It's like Wi-Fi is the number one thing in the Air Force, right? These days.
I was in V5 in the Navy, right?
Mm-hmm.
In 19. But I was when I went to Clark, they put me up for the night. The first time in the military I'd ever had a room to myself.
Oh, man. Clark Air Base. Yeah. many memories. Yeah, you see how that happens a lot. So you have a Marines, Army, they go to an Air Force base and they're like, wow, it's nice here. You know, it's just a different atmosphere.
The drawback was motions were slow in the Air Force.
Right.
I joined the Hickam Staff Sergeant and Up Club.
Okay.
In 1985. And it was, you know, and they never questioned me about being able to open up to drink because it was impossible for someone to be my career.
Yes.
To be 19 in the Air Force.
Yeah. Right, exactly. That's, you're 19 as an East. That's crazy. That's incredible to me. I mean, I must have been. I was older than that, but that's incredible. That's achievement there. You're a fast burner, they call it. So.
Well, the only thing is. When the general called me and told me I'd made colonel, I said, well, I was the youngest E6 once.
Wow.
At 21, I was an E6. So I said, the youngest E9 is going to be the oldest O6.
Wow. So what was your highest enlisted rank? Were you?
Oh, that was, I never stayed in a unit long enough to get promoted.
Gotcha.
I was supposed to get, finally it was in one unit long enough to become E7, and I was ready. I would have been promoted to chief in the Navy, but then I took an Army commission and never became a chief.
So it's rare to have somebody as an E7 become a colonel in the entire time. That is so rare. I don't think I've ever seen that before. I might have seen lieutenant colonel, but I've never seen that in my whole career. That's incredible. Congratulations, sir. You did it.
Oh, thank you, Rich.
Oh, my God. Wow. That's something I've never heard of before. Because that's a whole career. Both of them are whole careers, you know? So, I mean, you went for it. So I have hats off to that. That's incredible.
Well, I enjoyed it. So I get a check every month, so.
Yes, sir. Did you ever get injured while you were in the military? Do you have any VA benefits?
I never applied for any. At the time, it wasn't until recently they changed the law. There was no point if you had minor injuries if you were going to retire, because you might get partial exemption for your tax purposes. But after I left, they changed the law that said now you collect your VA benefits and your retirement check fully.
Interesting.
So people didn't buy. If you had minor injuries, if you were a career guy, you didn't bother.
Yeah, right. Yep.
It goes to the hassle, but the idea is that, and if you got the partial disability, it might end your career. So you didn't worry about it. You didn't ask. An officer would never apply for PTSD then either, that kind of stuff. He wouldn't apply for that. And you were careful about it. If you got a disability, it would end your career. So if you had a minor injury, you wouldn't tell them.
Yes. I know how that goes. I got kicked out because of an injury after 30 years. So I had no choice. I was disabled to do that. So
I wanted to keep going. So I wasn't that big of an injury. It was kind of stuff. And I used to tell people anyway, if you don't want to get shot, stand next to me. I've been in several ways. Nobody ever hits me. I got sniped at in Central America.
Oh, boy.
My dad wasn't for the UN. Rolled through a minefield and get injured. This kind of stuff. You know, nothing ever. When we were in Riyadh, we were right as we were in Scud Alley. We were north of Riyadh, and all the scuds came overhead.
Oh, boy.
People would go crazy. They'd rip their suits and stuff, try to put their stuff on, rushing on. To me, I figured if it happens, it happens.
Yeah.
I'd go hide, so I didn't have to put that hot suit on.
Right.
When they didn't hit us with WMDs with the scuds the first night, I figured they're not going to hit us with them. They're not going to use them. The purpose of that would be to catch us by surprise, and they're not going to use it later, so I'm not going to worry. I don't need that suit.
That's, I like your attitude because, you know, it is what it is, right? When you get hit or not, you don't have any control over that. And your job is to do your job. So that's why they do war games, right? That's why they get out and you have a mission to do and get it done as a team. So I appreciate that a lot. So you have anything else you'd like to say, sir?
No, I'm glad you put me on and got a chance to tell some war stories or whatever. Difference between my father once was in World War One, and he said he was the only private in World War One.
Wow.
And, that was the, I always try to take, when I tell a war story, oddly enough, I try to be accurate. Because I look at what my father said, my father wrote himself, and I always thought that when you tell a war story, you tell a war story, but try to stick to the facts.
Right. I agree. Interesting. World War One. So it took me for the Vietnam veterans, it took me a while to figure out that it was only 20 years before I was born. But you look at these movies and you look at these programs, it seems like it was, WW2 was only 20 years before I was born. It ended. And it's just like, you think about those things, and it wasn't that long ago. It's just, but you see all this black and white and everything, and they got color, and it's just like, it's a paradigm. It hit me like 20 years ago. I was like, wait a minute. So that's population boom and everything. So I just think that's fascinating. WW1, Revolutionary War, things like that. And
when I got home from my mother, who was active in the Legion, signed my brother and I up for the American Legion as soon as we got off active duty the first time. And I went to the Legion post, and the guys, the World War II guys, were looking for Vietnam-era allies because the World War I guys were still running the post.
Exactly.
My great-grandfather was in the Civil War. He was an Acadian, French-Canadian, Acadian immigrant, and he was disabled, and he was taken prisoner. He was with the 7th Vermont Volunteer Infantry. He was captured in the attack on Mobile, and Confederate cavalry picked him up, and he was disabled in a POW camp.
Oh, wow.
I spent 20 years trying to get a pension, and they finally loosened the rules. And they claimed being a POW didn't necessarily mean your disability was service-connected.
What?
POW camp, that was a vacation there.
There's a reason why you're in the camp, right? Something must have happened during wartime, yeah. Yeah.
Well, whatever. But it was just that, time is flies fast, and what you think is took place long ago, in some ways, isn't that long ago.
Right, exactly. Yeah, it's kind of, I mean, in your lifetime or my lifetime, a lot of things happened before you were born, and you have relatives that could tell you these things. My dad was in Vietnam. He was an air traffic controller there. You know, Air Force, easy job, right? So, but my uncles were art ground pounders, you know, in the wars and everything. And it's amazing. Then you have reenactors. I love the reenactors for the Civil War. I think that's pretty awesome. That shows where he came from and who he became. I like to keep that alive. So, and hopefully in the future we'll keep doing that and people will volunteer for that. And I like the tradition. I love tradition, military tradition. So is there anything else you'd like to say before we go? And let me tell you this. Anytime you want to come back on and become a panelist in some of my discussion groups, you're highly welcome to do that. So, you'll see my podcast on here and have a subject up. If you like the subject, then you're – free to come on and talk with us. I think tomorrow we're going to do old-time radio. I love old-time radio. I listen to it all the time.
Yeah. When we drive back and forth to Virginia, we listen to old-time radio.
Oh, yeah. I love all of it. It's like, things were so different then in the way people lived and the lifestyle and the comedy, and things were just honest and upfront. I like that a lot. You know, detective shows are my favorite. I love detective shows. Comedies are funny, and just people are so much more talented, it seems like, back then. It's all raw. So
you didn't have special effects, things like that. So you had to, writers had to rely on your writing ability, especially in radio. You didn't always high tech special effects as this action stuff that they show on entertainment now.
Right.
You actually had to hold the audience's attention with just talking them through their ear.
Exactly. So anyway, I'm so happy to have you as a guest tonight. I appreciate you coming on and talking to us and talking about yourself. I appreciate that. And any last words? Usually I ask how people can reach you. I know you're on Facebook. I don't know if you have anything else, anything you want to plug?
I don't have any special anything other than Facebook, and that's about it.
Awesome. Conrad Langley, thank you for being on the program tonight.
Thank you for having me.
It was my pleasure. Thank you very much, sir. And good night. All right. That was pretty awesome. This guy is so accomplished. I was very pleased. I'm very pleased to have you on, sir. And the resume is incredible. Stuff he's done and the ranks he's achieved is a fast burner. That's incredible. But anyway, that's it for the show tonight. I might be on tomorrow with James Boston. We're going to do OTR stuff, Old Time Radio. That's one of our James and I's passions. So probably see you tomorrow night if everything goes well. And the creek don't rise, right? Everybody have a good night, and God bless America. All right, here we go.